that fourth verse about firm, faithful, watching unto prayer reminds me so much of the book of Nehemiah and of Nehemiah himself. Toiling in God's vineyard, bearing the heat and burden of the day. May the Lord help us likewise. Let us look at the book of Nehemiah now in chapter 5. Nehemiah chapter 5. And we're going to bite off a rather large chunk here this afternoon, verses 1 through 13. But let's read first of all. And there was a great cry of the people and of their wives against their brethren the Jews. For there were that said, we, our sons and our daughters are many. Therefore we take up corn for them that we may eat and live. Some also there were that said, we have mortgaged our lands, vineyards, and houses that we might buy corn because of the dearth. There were also that said, we have borrowed money for the king's tribute, and that upon our lands and vineyards. Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children, and lo, we bring into bondage our sons and our daughters to be servants. And some of our daughters are brought unto bondage already, neither is it in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards. And I was very angry when I heard their cry and these words. Then I consulted with myself, and I rebuked the nobles and the rulers and said unto them, ye exact usury, every one of his brother. And I set a great assembly against them, and I said unto them, we after our ability have redeemed our brethren the Jews which were sold unto the heathen, and will ye even sell your brethren, or shall they be sold unto us? Then held they their peace, and found nothing to answer. Also I said, it is not good that ye do. Ought ye not to walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the heathen, our enemies? I likewise and my brethren and my servants might exact of them money and corn. I pray you, let us leave off this usury. Restore, I pray you, to them even this day their lands, their vineyards, their oliveyards, and their houses, also the hundredth part of the money and of the corn, the wine, and the oil that ye exact of them. Then said they, we will restore them, and will require nothing of them. So will we do as thou sayest. Then I called the priests and took an oath of them that they should do according to this promise. Also I shook my lap and said, so God shake out every man from his house and from his labor that performeth not this promise, even thus be he shaken out and emptied. And all the congregation said amen and praised the Lord. And the people did according to this promise. May the Lord bless the reading of his word to our hearts. These were intense weeks of hard manual labor in the midst of opposition of various kinds from without, from enemies surrounding the city, and in the midst of great danger. The people are working at what seems like a fever pitch to get the walls and gates built. And while all this is going on, there is another fire for Nehemiah to put out on a very different front. This was a threat not from without, but from within. Matthew Henry, commenting here, says, "Let Nehemiah build Jerusalem's walls ever so high, so thick, so strong. The city could not be safe while such abuses as these were tolerated." A wall around the city could not protect them from this kind of trouble. There's no doubt this was Satan's latest effort to put a stop to the work. He'd tried mockery, laughter, scorn. He had tried threats and then actual, at least coming very close to carrying out the threats. None of that had halted the work. It kept going on. And so here is another facet of Satan's attack. If we learn nothing else today from this passage, let us learn that challenges to the cause of God in this world never end. If we think we're going to have an easy time serving the Lord without any trouble or difficulty or opposition, we are mistaken. We are dreaming. That's heaven. And we're not going to have heaven on this earth. From a human standpoint, the timing could not have been worse for Nehemiah and the building effort. You have to wonder, did Nehemiah, or was he tempted to say, "People, can't you see that I'm busy up to my eyeballs in this work that is at hand? We don't have time for this." Well, I don't know if he thought such a thing or not. I think I would have. But we see here that God gave Nehemiah wisdom to add all of this to his workload. While he's being the building supervisor, he's also being the fireman to put out fires, so to speak. And God enabled him to resolve this crisis. I think we can safely call it a civil crisis in the city of Jerusalem. Now, verses 1 through 5 lay out the grievances. A great cry, verse 1. How this cry came, or how it came to Nehemiah's attention and to his ears, we're not told. But it must have been sort of the citywide subject of conversation. The conditions generally seem to be given in verse 2 and then some details in verses 3 through 5. There were that said, "We, our sons and our daughters, are many. Therefore, we take up corn for them." And when you see corn in the scriptures, think of grain of various kinds. "We take up corn for them that we may eat and live." There was a scarcity of food. And this was due to a drought, evidently. Verse 3 uses the word dearth or famine. The famine was probably the result of drought that the Lord had sent, according to the book of Haggai, chapter 1, because of the people's slowness to do all of the rebuilding that they should have done. Well, that made food scarce. Perhaps all these enemies surrounding them after Nehemiah had come, maybe they quit selling and trading with the people in Jerusalem as well. There could be more than one reason for the scarcity of food. But these people had large families, and they needed lots of food. They had many mouths to feed. The Old Testament instruction back in the book of Deuteronomy was that in times like those who were in better circumstances should reach out to and help those who were in trouble. Let me read from Deuteronomy 15. If there be among you a poor man or one of thy brethren within any of thy gates in thy land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, thou shalt not harden thine heart nor shut thine hand from thy poor brother, but thou shalt open thine hand wide unto him and shalt surely lend him sufficient for his need in that which he wanteth. And perhaps Nehemiah was familiar with the Proverbs of Solomon. We expect him to have been. And remember this proverb that says, he that hath pity upon the poor lendeth unto the Lord. And that which he hath given will he, the Lord, pay him again. Well, if those who had some means still in Jerusalem had been following the letter and spirit of the law, these conditions would not have developed, or at least this abuse would not have occurred. Conditions in Jerusalem were no doubt difficult before Nehemiah had arrived. But you can easily see how that this construction project and all that it demanded could force things to just a tipping point. With the men away from their livelihoods for these 7 weeks, 7.5 weeks, in a setting where they were truly living hand to mouth on a day to day basis, it would make a difficult situation unsustainable and would provide opportunity for these who were taking advantage of the poverty and the hunger of these men's families. You notice their wives are mentioned there in verse 1. There was a great cry of the people and of their wives against their brethren, the Jews. The wives are probably mentioned because the men had been involved in the work on the wall and the gates. And so, verse 3 explains that in order to have food, some had been forced to borrow money, using as collateral their own property, their own houses. Some also there were that said, we have mortgaged our lands, vineyards, and houses that we might buy corn, that we might buy food, buy grain because of the dearth. Added to that was a heavy tax burden, verse 4. There were also that said, we've borrowed money for the king's tribute. This is the Persian king. This could have been especially tricky for Nehemiah because he has been appointed governor here by that same king. And so he has some responsibility probably to collect some of the tax or tribute for that king. We have borrowed money for the king's tribute and that upon our lands and vineyards. The Persian palace was known for its great wealth. You remember reading in the book of Esther how that Ahasuerus put on this, was it 6 months long, a big party and national celebration and so on. Historians tell us that when Alexander the Great, the Greek conqueror, came to Shushan, the palace of Persia, in the following century, after the book of Nehemiah, he found about 270 tons of gold coin. 270 tons. I didn't do the math. I don't think I have a calculator that has that many digits. In addition, he found about 1,200 tons of silver bullion in storage. Well, where did they come up with all of that? Well, from taxation of their empire, among other things. Probably that was the main source. And so taxes were heavy. We don't know any more than that as far as amounts were concerned here. But it was a serious matter. You've got to pay your taxes. And so in order to pay taxes, some had to borrow money from their fellow Israelites. And they had to mortgage, again, their lands and vineyards. The very things that from which they made their livelihoods and provided sustenance for their own families. These things are now in jeopardy. And kind of reading between the lines here, you get the picture that some of these who held the mortgages are collecting. When the people can't pay, they come and seize the property. I mean, that's business. It's a dirty world, you know. Verse 5 even gives an even sadder picture. Yet now, our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. We are all fellow Jews. We're not Gentiles, and neither are those that are loaning us and holding mortgages on these things to us now. We are all one people. We're all one nation. I think that's the significance there of the first part of verse 5. And lo, we bring into bondage our sons and our daughters to be servants, servants unto our Jewish neighbors. And some of our daughters, our precious, vulnerable daughters, are brought unto bondage already. Neither is it in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards. The circumstances here were dire. This was indeed a civil crisis. We're talking not only about money and finances and livelihoods. We're talking about the disruption of family units. Satan has always been anti-family. And we've seen some of his boldest and most sickening attacks in just the last few years in our country and in our world. These people in verse 5 seem to be saying, our debts have been passed on to our children, but even worse than that, some of our children have actually been sold into slavery. According to Exodus 21, the daughters sold into slavery could be bought back or redeemed. And I find this interesting because if there is some significance to the order in which these Old Testament laws were given by God, you remember in Exodus chapter 20, we have the Ten Commandments, God speaking from Mount Sinai, And the very next chapter begins with these words. Now, these are the judgments which thou shalt set before them. If thou buy an Hebrew servant, 6 years he shall serve, and in the seventh he shall go out free for nothing. If he came in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he were married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master have given him a wife, and she have borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. And if the servant shall plainly say, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free, then his master shall bring him unto the judges, and he shall also bring him to the door, or unto the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. And if a man sell his daughter to be a maid servant, she shall not go out as the men servants do. If she please not her master, who hath betrothed her to himself, then shall he let her be redeemed. To sell her unto a strange nation he shall have no power, seeing he hath dealt deceitfully with her. And so this was evidently the kind of circumstance that's going on here in Jerusalem in Nehemiah's day. These people have sold their daughters as slaves. They want to buy them back, and they have no means by which to do so. Their lands and vineyards have already been mortgaged or taken. These conditions were worse, evidently, than anything that they had suffered in Babylon or Persia. They were being treated by their own fellow Jews in a way worse than the heathen had treated them. They might as well have stayed in Persia. Well, these are the grievances. What do we learn here? Crises within a church are especially grievous and difficult. Divisions within an assembly are certainly devilish. Professing Christians can be surprisingly cruel and heartless sometimes. And we ought to seek to avoid such trouble and not be troublemakers. Let us rather be merciful, remembering how merciful God has been unto us. Helpful, remembering how helpful God is to us. Patient, benevolent, and so on, as God is to us. Well, when such trouble arises, we need wisdom like Nehemiah had. And let's look at his rebuke here and his exhortation. It all begins in verse 6. He tells us his internal thoughts. First of all, I was very angry when I heard their cry and these words. You know, there is sinful anger and there is righteous anger. And the New Testament says, be ye angry and sin not. If the presence and prevalence of sin anywhere does not in some way make us angry, it may be that our heart is not right with God or not where it ought to be. That which is an offense to Him should be an offense to us. That which evokes His wrath should rightly evoke our wrath. If Nehemiah had not been very angry upon hearing all of this, something would have been wrong with him. There is a time for righteous indignation. When we see biblical principles violated, we see God's law trampled underfoot, the next thing that he did is worded in a rather strange way to our ears. He says, "Then I consulted with myself." The margin of my Bible reads, "My heart consulted in me." He gave it careful consideration, serious thought. It could be that something even stronger is involved here when it says, "I consulted with myself." Perhaps he had to get himself under control and make sure his anger was not spilling over into the sinful category before he begins to try to correct these others. He had to make sure there was no beam in his own eye first. When I read this, I think maybe a paraphrase would be something like this: "Then I counted to 10 to make sure that I'm right in my own heart. Is there not a lesson for us here? We must govern our own spirit if we are to govern others and lead others in any way, in any right way. We cannot solve problems by losing control over ourselves. That only adds to the problem. And we should prayerfully, carefully consider and ponder the best course of action. You know, though it is not stated here, knowing what we know of Nehemiah as a man of prayer, and how many times here in the book of Nehemiah it says that he prays and some of his prayers are recorded, I think it's safe to say that when he consulted with himself, he was also in serious prayer to heaven. And so then here comes the rebuke. "I rebuked the nobles and the rulers." These evidently were the ones who were the offenders here. The ones in more power and wealth were taking unfair advantage of the poor. And he says, "Ye exact usury, every one of his brother." What's he saying here? This seems to be sort of a summary accusation of all of the abuses mentioned from verses 3 through 5. He's laying out the case in terms of the law of God. He's showing them that they have not simply violated Nehemiah's better judgment and best recommendations. They have violated in a specific way the law of God. And he refers here to the law concerning usury or interest. And it's set forth in several places in the first 5 books of the Old Testament. Let me just read a couple here from Exodus. "If thou lend money to any of my people that is poor by thee, thou shalt not be to him as a usurer, neither shalt thou lay upon him usury. In an economy that was stable, that did not suffer the evil of inflation, a piece of gold today would have the same value as a piece of gold next year. And the person who had to borrow could pay back the same exact amount without any interest added, without any penalty. And that's what God said to do in the case of a fellow Jew. Now, if they were loaning money to a Gentile, they could charge interest. In Deuteronomy, we read once again, thou shalt not lend upon usury to thy brother. And notice the emphasis here about a brother, a fellow Israelite. And that's what Nehemiah says here. Ye exact usury, every one of his enemy, his Gentile neighbor, no, his brother. Unto a stranger thou mayest lend upon usury, but unto thy brother thou shalt not lend upon usury. And so on. In fact, if you recall, we saw this earlier this morning in Psalm 15. The one who abides in God's tabernacle, among other things, is he that putteth not out his money to usury. Well, this is the accusation against the nobles and the rulers. They are not above the law. There is much injustice when those who are in positions of wealth or power are not punished for the same offenses that those in lesser circumstances are punished for. Verse 8 continues. Verse 7, I'm sorry. And I set a great assembly against them. He's making a public meeting here. Obviously, work on the wall has to stop in order to put out this fire before it rages into an inferno and puts a stop to the work altogether for good. He calls this great assembly as witness. And I said unto them, we, after our ability, have redeemed our brethren the Jews, which were sold unto the heathen. Now, exactly when that occurred, we don't know. It could have occurred during captivity. It could have occurred even after the return here to Palestine. They were doing everything they could. They were spending their money to try to get those who were in bondage set free. They're buying freedom for their fellow Jews. And he says, and look at you. Will ye even sell your brethren? Far from setting them free, you're continuing the bondage. You may sell them like property to no telling who. Maybe you're going to sell them to the heathen. You're undoing what we have labored and spent our wealth to do. Or shall they be sold unto us? Are you going to sell them to your fellow Jews? Nehemiah says, some of us have been doing all we can to secure the liberty of fellow Jews from Gentile hands. But you're buying them as slaves. Matthew Poole puts it this way. Do you expect that we should pay you a price for them as we did to the Babylonians? If we are prepared to redeem out of the bondage in your hands, these daughters of inhabitants here of Jerusalem, that puts you in the same position as the heathen from which we have redeemed some of our brethren. He exposes their evil here. You're behaving like the heathen in so many words. And they couldn't answer him. Then held they their peace and found nothing to answer. Guilty as charged, ashamed, exposed. In verse 9, he bids them to consider the bigger picture. And I said, it is not good that ye do. Now that's an understatement, isn't it? Ought ye not to walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the heathen, our enemies? Here is one motivation for obeying God. It is, what will the heathen neighbors and enemies say and think about God by what he sees in us? They hear about what you're doing, and they'll say, well, their God is no different than ours. Beloved, the reputation of God rests upon our shoulders as his people. And this ought to be a great motivation for us to walk carefully and in a holy and godly way before this world. He that oppresseth the poor reproacheth his maker. It reflects upon God. Nehemiah is saying in so many words, this is a time for mercy. For one another. Blessed are the merciful, Jesus said. On the other hand, those who have no mercy will receive no mercy. The book of James tells us, he shall have judgment without mercy that hath showed no mercy. An attitude of mercy would have sent a very different signal to the Gentiles observing what was going on there in Jerusalem. You know, the Apostle Paul appeals to this very thing when he, to the church at Corinth, when he talks about their going to court one against another, and he says, you're going before these unbelieving judges, and the implication is, what are they going to think of you? When this makes the headlines in the paper, what's the world going to think and say? They're going to say, oh, that religion, that Christianity, it's meaningless. It's worthless. They live just the same way as we do, after all. The enemies of the gospel are always ready to exploit our weaknesses and our failures and our divisions and our lack of compassion. And that's very damaging to the cause that we want to advance and help. One writer puts the question this way: are some people outside the church because I am inside? Well, that's a searching question, isn't it? May God help us to be good examples in these things. Well, we hasten on. Verse 10. And there's difficulty of translation here, but our English Bible here reads, I likewise and my brethren and my servants might exact of them money and corn. I pray you let us leave off this usury. Some think that Nehemiah had actually been exacting usury. But our translators here, I think, are correct that what Nehemiah is saying is evidently he had loaned out no telling what in the way of food and money to the needy without demanding payment, without seizing collateral, without taking slaves, and so on. I likewise and my brethren and my servants might exact of them money and corn, but we haven't. We've given them more time. We haven't added interest and penalties. I pray you, let us leave off this usury. And this us here is especially interesting. He speaks in the first person, evidently to reach their hearts and to be persuasive in a personal way. And it's also an indication that the sin of some had made a bad impact on the whole community. I pray you, let us leave off this usury. He calls for restitution, verse 11. Restore, I pray you, to them even this day their lands, their vineyards, their olive yards, and their houses. Also the 100th part of the money and of the corn and wine and oil that ye exact of them. Though the return of slaves is not mentioned here, it is assumed that if the lesser would lead or would include the greater. And there is a hint here about the amount of interest or usury that they had charged, the 100th part. So that's 1%. What we're not told is if it was 1% per month, which would be 12% interest. It could even have been 1% per week, which would be 52% interest. Whatever the case, this was forbidden by the Lord altogether. And he tells them, pay them back their interest. Well, moving on here, we come to the response of these nobles and rulers. And I think Nehemiah must have breathed a sigh of relief because he doesn't know how they're going to respond or if they're going to put up a fight and throw him out of office or something. Then said they, we will restore them and we'll require nothing of them. We will carry what we've loaned. Either they're going to write off the loan or the debt, or at least not require payment anytime soon. We will do as thou sayest. That was a happy day in Jerusalem, wasn't it? When people respond to the instruction of the Word of God positively, it's a happy day. How do we respond to the Word of God? Are we corrigible or incorrigible? May God help us to take correction and to change whatever needs to be changed when we see it in the Word of God, and to appreciate those who show us our sin and not to hate them or dig in our heels in our sin. Well, there was this public commitment then in these closing words, beginning in the middle of verse 12, Nehemiah says, then I called the priests. Well, as the religious leaders of the city and of the nation of Israel, these were called as witnesses. I called the priests and took an oath of them that they should do according to this promise. He makes the rulers and nobles promise the priests. There's a public commitment enacted here by Nehemiah. Private commitments are sometimes forgotten, conveniently forgotten or ignored. But matters of public record with witnesses and oaths and promises are more likely to stand. And so this is what Nehemiah did. And then he warns them of judgment in verse 13. Also I shook my lap and said, God, so God shake out every man from his house and from his labor that performeth not this promise, even thus be he shaken out and emptied. He's dramatizing this curse that he's pronouncing upon any who do not abide by their word. Whoever fails to keep his word on this will be shaken loose of his property just as easily as I have shaken the folds out of my robe here, he says in so many words. And all the congregation said amen and praised the Lord. You can hear a sigh of relief not only on the part of Nehemiah, but on the part of the oppressed people. And maybe the best part is at the end of verse 13, the people did according to this promise. There was action. Not just intention, not just promise, but action. And we need to be people of action to fulfill our promises to God and to one another. Now, I just want to make a couple of brief observations here as we conclude. Some might come to Nehemiah chapter 5 here and think that they have found some basis for the critical theory movement that is sweeping our nation today, that says something like this: power is intrinsically evil, all power is oppression, and those who are oppressed should rise up and fight against their oppressors. Government should get involved. Government should be redistributing the wealth and assuring equality of outcome for everyone. Nehemiah was as far from that as could be. He was no social justice warrior. Rather, he simply insisted that the letter and spirit of the law of God be followed. And that's a very different path and philosophy than critical theory and what's called social justice today. He was simply calling for an end of exploitation and instead calling for compassion and true benevolence. You know, the Lord taught that way back there in the law of Moses. When they harvested the fields, they were to leave a little bit of the harvest for the poor and needy to come and take. They weren't required to gather it for them and deliver it to their door. The poor and needy were to come and harvest it themselves. It was not a welfare arrangement, anything like what we have today, obviously. But the Lord did teach pity and compassion for the needy. That's the biblical principle. And those who work should work, or who can work should work. And so the Lord graciously resolved this civil unrest, this civil crisis. And after we see the following verses of this chapter, we see that work on the wall continued on. Thank the Lord. Internal conflicts in the church eat like cancer. And if they are not resolved, the work of the Lord comes to a crashing halt. And we need to pray for, first of all, deliverance from such conflicts. And when there are such things, we must be determined to resolve them biblically, fairly, and swiftly. And may the Lord deliver us. And when he doesn't deliver us, may he give us wisdom to know what we should do.